I'm Marty Moss Colwain. Welcome to The Connection. How many of you want to talk about death and dying today? It's going to happen to all of us. It's something we all have in common. And yet we either don't want to discuss our mortality or we don't know how. After all, it's scary. Our guest, end-of-life doula Diane Button, has spent almost two decades talking with people who are facing their own death. Her job is to help them find some peace and clarity. In return, they have given her vitally useful information about how to live a life of meaning and purpose. It turns out that it's the little things, the simple pleasures, that are the most meaningful. So is learning to live in the moment. Her new book is titled What Matters Most? Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. Diane Button volunteered at a nursing home in high school where she enjoyed hearing the residents' stories and later worked in the ER at a hospital. But it was her grandfather's death that inspired her to be a doula. She realized she had so many questions she had never asked him. Diane Button is a founding partner of the Bay Area End of Life Doula Alliance, and she joins us today on The Connection. And Diane, nice to have you with us on the show to talk about this important issue.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really wonderful to be here today.
Nice to have you with us. Let's begin with your grandfather, Grandpa Charlie. You write about a meal that the family had with him about a week before he died, when he said something that really surprised a lot of the family. What did he say?
Well, he was going around the room kind of looking at us one by one and taking us all in as if I knew he was getting close to end of life, but as if it was really our final meal, which it did turn out to be. And he was a very soft-spoken man, and he held a lot of his feelings inside because I think he experienced a lot of grief in his life working as a surgeon with burn victims, and he was just never demonstrative. So that particular night, he leaned forward and he looked at us all one by one, and he leaned in even more and he said, "When I die, I'm really going to miss." And I thought, okay, that's it. He's going to finally express himself. And he said, "When I die, I'm really going to miss mint jelly." And it just made us laugh because he was eating his favorite meal that night that my mom had prepared for him with mint jelly. But it just really struck me. He's just such a beautiful man, and he was my hero, and we just didn't get to have the conversations. And so that really started my journey about wanting to talk about death and dying and life.
Well, he died. Yeah, and he died, as you described him, with a smile on his face.
Yeah, that was another beautiful part about my grandfather's life, was that I think he lived a really meaningful and purposeful life, and I think he loved really deeply in his own way. And when he died, I was holding him, and he had this huge smile, and it was the biggest smile I'd ever seen on his face. Right. And I just sat and looked at him, and it was kind of one of those moments when the church bells rung and there was a breeze blowing. It was just magical. And I just thought, how do I die with a smile on my face like that? And yet another motivation to kind of lean into existential psychology and what is a meaningful life and how can I die with a smile on my face one day?
Well, the logical follow-up question is, especially having spent so many hours with people who are dying, I'm sure you have thought about your own death and if you have some control over it, what you want it to be like. So what is your vision?
Well, I have two answers to that. Sort of there's a vision for life, right, which is maybe a different conversation, but how do I get there? How do I live my life so that when I get there, I feel that peace and comfort that my grandfather had? And then there's the day of and the week of and my own end-of-life journey. I have to say that I don't really know exactly how I'm going to respond. And I think that we all need to give ourselves that grace of just being whatever we need to be when the time comes, whatever emotions need to come up. I might be more emotional than I would have ever thought I could be, but I might be more stoic than I also think I would be. But I know that when my day comes, I will have said what I needed to say to every single person in my life, and that I'm not going to have a lot of lingering unfinished business, because I make it a point to take care of that in my own life each and every month. And as things come up, I try not to build things up, because I see the franticness and the distress that it can cause at the end of life. So I think I live a life in a way that will prevent me from having to deal with at least that at the end of life.
I love your clarity about it. Obviously, you've thought a lot about it, having spent so many hours with people who are dying. But I think about the euphemisms that we use when we talk about death, or even the sort of denial that we have. I mean, I don't know that I want to live my life knowing that I could die today. I mean, that seems kind of overwhelming. But how do you live sort of knowing that our time is short and it's finite?
Well, I think one of the greatest lessons that I've learned from those facing the end of life is just the simplicity of an ordinary day, and to remember that it's not the big firework events that make a life and build a life. But the way that I look at it is, I always want to be kind of prepared to die in case it were to happen, but I don't live my life like I'm going to die tomorrow. I live my life like I'm healing as I go. I'm saying the words as I go. I'm saying thank you, I'm sorry, I love you. And I'm saying what I need to say to certain people all along the way. And I think that just kind of keeps me as a bit of a clean slate, so that if it were to happen tomorrow, I would feel prepared. Or if I were to get that terminal diagnosis tomorrow and I felt like my life had been upended, I wouldn't have to go back over 2, 5, 10, 20, however many years, and think about all the people that I might need to reach out to or say I'm sorry to. I think that when we pay attention to those things in our everyday life and we meet the moments as they come up and don't hold on to things, I think it makes it a lot more peaceful at the end of life.
I find the older I get, the more mortal I feel. I'm getting close to the age when my parents died, so that does kind of focus the mind when you realize that's a kind of reality. I've also lost friends. I've lost family members. You know, death and illness feels like more of a reality. We kind of joke with our friends that when we get together, if we're similarly of the same generation, we have this so-called organ recital where we describe, you know, all the aches and pains and bad vision and hurt knees that we have, and sort of get that over with and then get to the sort of meat of the matter. But I do find sort of getting older, I'm much more aware of the conscience of the passage of time.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I do think it is that kind of stories about our body aches and such that do start becoming the predominant part of the conversation. So for me, as an end-of-life doula, I like the second part.
Right.
You know, like, let's get the aches and pains out. We have to say them. We need to talk about it. We need to feel comfortable sharing. But then what? You know, we've got these aches and pains and we're slowing down in certain ways and things are becoming more urgent in other ways. And so now what? What are we going to do with that so that we can live fully and live with joy and meaning all the way up until the end?
What does a doula do? What do you see as your job when you are with someone who is obviously dying or looking at the last days, maybe weeks of their life?
Well, one of the important things to remember about an end-of-life doula is that we're completely non-medical. So we are not involved in anything to do with the doctor care, you know, the medical care or the hospice care, but we do interact with them quite deeply, actually. But our job is really about having the hard conversations, about working on legacy and life review, and the things that will bring that comfort and peace at the end of life, the practical, emotional, spiritual issues that come up at the end of life. And then as a person gets closer to death, maybe within a week or a few days, we start showing up more. We might sit vigil. We might bring in a team where we sit with somebody 24 hours until they die, especially if they're alone and they want to have somebody with them. And then once somebody dies, we're often the ones who will call the mortuary and we wait for the mortuary to come and take the body away so that the family doesn't have to do that alone. So also remember that a lot of times people call us when they don't have a diagnosis. Some people are calling us just because they want to do their advanced directives, or maybe they're afraid of their own mortality and death and dying and what's ahead, and they just want to talk through some things. So our clients range in all different, you know, statuses of life and end of life. But we really do work mostly with people when they get a terminal diagnosis. That's when most people reach out to us.
And I assume the people who reach out because most people don't have an end-of-life doula, that most people who reach out want to have some of these conversations, want to deal with perhaps some issues that are unresolved in their own life or maybe in the life of their family.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the most beautiful parts of our work is that when someone calls us, it's because they want to get real, they want to go deep, they want to finish well, they want to have the conversations. I just spoke to somebody the other day and he said, can you help me to say goodbye? And he's got lots of friends and he's got grandkids and all different kinds of relationships in his life, a couple that have some unresolved issues. And we're going to talk through them one by one so that he can say goodbye to everyone in the way that feels meaningful to him.
I was thinking that, and it's, I think it's true for a lot of us who are maybe untrained or haven't had this kind of experience, is we don't know what to do. We don't know what to say. You know, we don't know how to be quiet. We don't know how to sort of fill the room with conversation. And you talk about something called a beginner's mind. Someone gave you advice about sort of how to enter a relationship or even a room with a beginner's mind. What is that?
Well, it's nothing that I created. It's been around for a long, long time. And it just really is about showing up without knowing all the answers. It's really the simple, simple way of being silent, listening, and not feeling like you need to know everything. So when I go to see a client, when I get ready to knock on the door, I think about my beginner's mind and I let go and I realize I don't need to know all the answers. I don't know what's waiting for me on the other side of the door and I don't want to know and I don't need to know. I just know that I'm going to be there and I'm going to show up and be present. And that way I'm open to whatever my client or my client's family or friends or whoever's gathered on the other side of the door needs to talk about. So I can be open to whatever comes up that day. So it's just a way of being still and not feeling like you need to have all the answers. It's really a beautiful way of realizing that none of us are experts. Every death is different. Every story is different. Every person's journey is different. And I would be foolish to act like I knew what another person was going through on any particular day.
Almost up on our first break here. But so what does it mean to just to sit and be present? What does that mean?
It means to just allow whatever emotions are in the room to show up without judgment, without an agenda, and to be the calmest person in the room so that you can just hold space for it all, so that you can be there to support if someone needs or wants a hug, but also to be very, very comfortable just sitting in silence. Because sometimes the most profound work we do happens in the silent moments.
Oh, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Diane Button is our guest today on The Connection. She is an end-of-life doula, and she's written a brand new book. It's called What Matters Most, and it's subtitled Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. And she spent almost 20 years with people who are in various stages of dying, in conversation with them, sometimes in silence with them. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is Diane Button. She's an end-of-life doula. She has spent many hours with people in their last days as they share their regrets, their joys, their hopes, desires, and dreams, and sometimes their silence. And she's written about what she has learned about living and dying in her new book. It's titled What Matters Most. So let's talk about sitting in the silence that you've referenced. I think that's very hard for us mere mortals to do.
It is. It is. And I think it's a challenge that we can practice in our day-to-day lives. Just like all the work that I do with people at the end of life, there are so many tools that we can take with us into our everyday life. And I think silence is such an important tool, not the kind of silence necessarily when you're meditating, but the pause, the power of the pause, you know, because sometimes it's easy to get caught up in the spoken word. And I find a lot of times when I just sit in stillness, it's the unspoken words, it's the energy in the room, it's the mood, it's the pause. If I ask a question and wait and wait and wait, for someone to respond, where they actually have time to process it and think about it, that the most powerful conversations take place. So I always look for what's being said, but I also like to pay attention to what isn't being said as well and realize that there are some nuggets in there.
How important is touch for someone who is dying? And I'm thinking of, you know, someone who might have their body might be deteriorating. So you worry, you know, does this feel good or does this not feel good? How should we think about touch?
Always ask first. Always ask permission before you touch somebody. And realize that that's true. Some people are in pain. Some people just don't like to be touched. Some people might just want their feet touched and nothing else. And another thing is, you know, sometimes when you put your hand on top of somebody, it can feel a little bit like claustrophobic and holding down. So a lot of times I like to, if somebody wants to touch hands, I will just gently put my hand under theirs so they can put their hand on top of mine. And if they feel like sliding it away, they can. I think we have to ask permission and give people the autonomy and the ability to shift and say that they don't want that as well at any time.
I've been with people who are dying, and there's this, I would describe it as a kind of netherworld where at some point their eyes are open, they might be nodding their head, it looks like they might be processing what's going on, then they close their eyes and I'm not sure where they are, you know. One of the things you say is that it's hearing it is the last to go. So I'm assuming even if they're not speaking or using any of their other senses, they are hearing what's going on in the room.
Yeah, and we've actually observed that to be the case when we aren't sure if people can hear us, and then they might have a rally and wake up a little bit later and have a conversation and realize that they did hear us. Mm-hmm. And so we always encourage family members, loved ones, caregivers that are gathered around someone to keep speaking to them, because we hope that they can hear us. And sometimes people like to have permission to let go, or it feels good to be told that your life mattered and that you're going to be missed and that you're loved. And so we always like to encourage people to keep speaking those words up until the very last breath.
It's interesting. There are end of life doulas like yourself, and there are birth doulas. Is there something about the body that the body sort of knows how to do these things, sometimes with some help, but that there's something about the sort of body's intelligence or even intuition that we need to acknowledge?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the ways to look at it is the body knows how to give birth, and the body also knows how to die. We know how to be born, we know how to die, and the birth doulas usher people into the world, and the end-of-life doulas help usher people out of the world. But our bodies are in charge, and we do know how to do this.
I'm thinking about pain, and oftentimes people in end-of-life are in some degree of discomfort, if not pain. Do we have the kind of technology and medicine and tools to help relieve people's pain at the end of life? And do we use it?
I think hospice is the answer to that for most people. And the idea that, yes, we do have it, yes, we do use it, but you can't guarantee that everybody's going to die absolutely pain-free. There is sometimes suffering at the end of life. But I think one of the beautiful parts of having a doula on board is that we work so closely with the doctors and so closely with the hospices that when we're around, and we tend to be around in someone's home, especially towards the end, more often than the hospice, just because we have the time that we can spend with people. So we'll reach out to hospice and we all work together to make sure that pain is managed as best as possible.
What's terminal lucidity?
Well, there are times where people seem to go in and out. You know, I think of it as sort of an in-between stage in the veil between life and death, and where they're really maybe not conscious and not speaking, but there is an awareness. And so I think it's a very transitional time.
You also describe, and people describe seeing dead relatives or dead loved ones. I mean, I guess to them, it's a very real experience. If we're sitting with someone, how should we experience that?
We meet them where they are. So the thing about these end-of-life visions and dreams is that I think they bring so much comfort to people at the end of life that it's actually one of the sources of peace for me in my own end of life experience. When it comes, it's kind of something I'm looking forward to.
Really?
Seeing my grandfather again, or if who's going to show up. Because so often people reach out or they'll call someone's name out. And I've had experiences where I've been with a client who said somebody's name and waving like they were in the room. And I was the only person in the room with them. And then later I ask a family member who was, you know, such and such a person. And they say, oh, that was his best friend in high school who died in a car wreck. Or that was somebody who he was in the war with. You know, you hear these stories and it makes you realize that there is this transition that takes place. Mm-hmm. And I think that people find comfort in those who have gone before them.
Finding some kind of joy in reconnecting.
It's beautiful. And it's so amazing when it happens that you don't want to interrupt it. You never want to take away that joy from somebody. You want to give somebody the opportunity to experience that peace that's happening for them. So that's why I said, just meet them where they are. You know, just don't interrupt and tell people they're hallucinating or seeing things, because for them, this is a very important part of their end of life experience.
I've seen people take their last breath. And it is so profound, where before that breath, they are alive, even if they, you know, they're alive, even if they're not talking or their eyes are closed. And then they take that final breath and you can see that they're not alive anymore. It's profound.
Yeah, it's very profound. It's very profound. You sometimes can witness the breath slowly, slowly leaving. Yes, and that final breath is a powerful moment. And I always like to remember that people are alive up until that very last breath. So that's why we talk to people, and that's why we remember that, so that we can honor people and talk to them and be present with them up until the very last breath.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Diane Button, our guest today on The Connection. She's an end-of-life doula. She's spent about 20 years or so with people in the final stages of their life, and she's written a new book that's called What Matters Most: Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. You talk about medical aid in dying, which is called MAID in California. I think there's something like 13 states plus the District of Columbia that allows some form of I don't know if it's called assisted suicide, but certainly allowing the terminally ill to end their life. You described a client, they all have pseudonyms in the book, a woman named Shauna, where she had picked the date that she wants to die on. And one of the things you said about this was that was one of the most emotional parts of your work, working with someone who had sort of chosen to end their life in the way, I guess, they could best control themselves.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more clients choosing the End of Life Option Act. And it's a very powerful and profound end of life experience. We don't call it assisted suicide. We call it medical aid in dying. And the reason for that is because, at least from my perspective, these people don't really want to die. They just don't want to keep living like this. And so they're choosing to end their life and thereby end their suffering. And so I find it really emotional, just because I've never been in that situation before. And I said earlier, I don't know how I'm going to respond to my own death. And the same would be true with aid in dying. I don't know if I would choose it or not. It would depend on a lot of factors. But it's emotional because somebody is actually saying, I'm going to ingest this medication next Tuesday or something like that. So you realize that there's all these lasts that this person is experiencing, you know, the last cup of coffee, the last walk with a friend, or the last visit from a friend, or whatever it might be. It's going to be the last night, the last shower. And I just find that to be one of the most profound and amazing thoughts to have and just to contemplate. And I know it takes a lot of courage to do medical aid in dying, but I also know it's bringing a tremendous amount of peace to a lot of people.
You write about some of the things that were unsaid, and I guess certainly people have regrets. We all have regrets of things we either did or didn't do. And I'll just read a couple of quotes about regrets. And this is Frank, age 78. I need to write a letter to my children to open after I die. There's so many times I wanted to begin and I just kept putting it off. I hope it's not too late. Janelle, age 64, says, I have forgiven everyone who has ever hurt me, teased me, or harmed me in any way. I just wish I could forgive myself too. Benton, age 60, says, my sister told me never to call her again, so I didn't. That was 30 years ago. We haven't spoken since then. Can you help me call her today? I'm dying and I want to say goodbye. Those are just so moving and so heartbreaking. But the fact that they were able to express them to you, I guess in some way helps people unburden themselves.
Yeah, I think that's the first part of healing, is being able to talk about it with someone who's not going to judge you, or maybe with somebody who's not even going to try to fix it, because some things just can't be fixed. And so sometimes just being able to share, or to write a letter that never gets sent, or to make a phone call that never gets returned, is a profound and powerful thing to do. And so we just like to make space for those regrets and the guilt and anything that might be unfinished, so that we can bring some sort of closure, even if it's not the way that the person would have loved to have written the story, mm-hmm. had they had control over how it would end, at least to be able to make some steps in their own life so that they can feel at peace with the actions that they took later on.
Do you think people tell you things they have never told anyone else in their life?
I think so. Yes, I do. I think they tell me things at a time where they really need and want to get something off their chest. And of course, that comes with building trust. And I think that's part of the work of the doula, and why we really appreciate it when people call us sooner rather than later, mm-hmm. because we have time to get to know people and build that trust so that we become a safety net to just hold whatever is being carried by someone.
And what do you think it means to unburden oneself, either for regrets or secrets, you know, those things that can really weigh heavy?
Well, I see what causes distress at the end of life, and I see the agitation and the lack of peace that comes from not being able to unburden yourself. So I think it seems as if it's a big weight being lifted off someone's back when they're able to just breathe out and let go and realize that this is the most that they're going to get in terms of peace and completion and closure to whatever their circumstances are. Sometimes there is healing. Sometimes we do reunite people. Sometimes we do send letters that get opened and phone calls do get returned, but sometimes they don't. And so I think that heaviness can be lifted even without having that full resolution that one might hope for.
You tell the story about a woman you call Carrie. She actually had left her children, left her family for another man. And then she found years later that she had cancer, in fact, was dying of a rare form of cancer. And she said to you, I'm dying and I'm a terrible mother. Again, you know, heartbreaking to hear somebody say that. What is her story? What did she do? What did she and her children do?
Well, it took a while. Her kids were teenagers. Her two daughters were teenagers. And at first, she wasn't really reaching out. She didn't know how to reach out. So we started something called a letterbox. It's something I have for all my children. And she started writing her children letters to open on their 25th birthday and to open on their wedding day and to open on all the milestones of their lives that she would most likely not be there to celebrate with them. And that was the start of healing for her. But over time, she was able to reconnect with her children, and they spoke on the phone a few times, and we had some really deep conversations about her traveling, because she was getting a lot weaker as well. And at the end, she did fly back, and she was reunited with her children at the end of her life, and it was quite beautiful. And it's also beautiful that they have all these letters to open for the rest of their life with little poems and little bracelets and things that she had collected that Carrie had saved over the years that she might have put in the envelopes for her daughters. And it was really a touching, sweet ending to a really sad story.
Indeed. You say the most frequent questions people have, and again, this is at end of life, did I love well? Was I loved? Do the people I love know that I love them. I mean, those are three really profound and moving questions, really, to I guess, ask oneself whether there are answers to those questions.
What I find so powerful about it is all the other stuff that gets stripped away. The awards on your wall, you know, the vacations that you've taken, the fancy clothes in your drawer, the car, the house, all that stuff, you know, even for a lot of people, their garden and things that they've tended to for a long, long time become less and less important. And what matters most and what seems to stay in the room after someone dies is love. And so I think that's really the most important question. People also want to know, did my life matter? Yeah. Did I make a difference? Is the world a better place because I was here? I mean, those are questions that we can work through as doulas with our clients all along the way. But the love and the people that are surrounding you at the end of your life, I think that's the key and the most important piece. And, you know, the third question, do the people I love know that I love them?
Yeah.
That's like a legacy. That's a reminder to speak the unspoken words.
What do you think holds us back from saying, I love you?
Yeah. Some families, it's just not the norm. Even it might not even be those words that need to be said, but to pause enough to tell somebody how they've made a difference in your life and what they mean to you. Even if you don't feel comfortable saying the words, I love you, say something. Say to that person that you love what they mean to you and how they've changed your life, how you're a better person because of them. It doesn't have to be, I love you.
But even more than showing it, it's important to say it.
Yeah, I think showing it is really important. My grandfather showed it.
Right.
My whole life, I knew I was loved, but I sure would have loved also to have heard some words from him that were more meaningful at the end of his life or during his life, but that's not who he was. So he showed his love to me in different ways, and that was okay. I mean, to answer the question, do the people you love know that you love them? My grandfather did show me. It's just not the traditional way. And that's okay too.
That is okay too. Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Diane Button. She's an end-of-life doula, and she's written a new book called What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. And it's what she learned as she listened to and talked to people in the final stages of their life. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Diane Button. She's an end-of-life doula and has spent many hours talking with people at the end of their life. And today on the show, she is sharing with us what she has learned from the dying about how to face our mortality with purpose and courage and clarity. Her book is titled What Matters Most. You said some things during our conversation that got me thinking about the sort of ordinary things of life, about the importance of making them almost like sacraments, even making a cup of coffee as a kind of early morning ritual to make it have such meaning built in the kind of ritual. And there's so many little things that we do during the day that we could make sacramental.
Oh, absolutely. I think that really life is made up of a string of ordinary days, ordinary moments with big firework moments thrown in.
Yes.
You know, right. And we think about it as the fireworks, like where's my next vacation and the next job promotion and, you know, the new this and such. But really, life is a string of ordinary moments and ordinary days. And we tend to be always searching for the next big moment. And I think if we could just remember to pause and think about what we do every day. And some people I know make rituals out of things like brushing their teeth,
right,
you know,
right,
where they look in the mirror and they maybe give themselves a positive affirmation, or they send off a prayer to somebody or whatever it is that feels like a sacred moment to them. we can make sacred moments throughout our day, and we do it anyway. Usually when we get up in the morning, we do similar thing every day. We might drink a similar beverage in the morning, have a similar breakfast, and so it starts our day. And so I think even just driving down our street when we're coming home in the evening to just use that time to breathe out and let go and realize that you're stepping into your home and having your certain rituals that you pay attention to. When people get sick and they start becoming more homebound, those are the things that matter most. And you start, I see it every single day when I'm working with people, that it's the little things. It's the phone call from a daughter or a son every day or something like that that becomes the most special part of someone's day.
Can you tell when you go into a house or apartment, you've knocked on the door the first time, can you kind of read what's going on inside the house? Are we that obvious as human beings?
Sometimes I can. Okay. Usually I can sense emotions. I can see fear, but I don't know somebody's story, and I don't want to know until I get in and figure it out. But a lot of times I see emotions right when I step in. And maybe I might get a good sense of who might need to talk to me that day. It's not always the client. Sometimes it's somebody else that's sitting in the room who's struggling that I need to have a conversation with that might support the client at the end, you know, just to create some calm in a room. But definitely I like to keep myself 100% wide open to whatever stories need to be told.
There's a surprising amount of joy in these stories that you write about. And each chapter is about another person or several people going through something similar. Does it surprise you the kind of joy maybe you can stumble on when you're with someone who's dying?
Well, it doesn't surprise me anymore. It did in the beginning, because there's so much laughter. And I realized that people are who they are. And if you're funny or you make jokes about things, and even if you make jokes about serious things, that might be who you are. And funny things happen. And, you know, things get said that are taken that weren't intentionally meant to be said in that context that makes everybody laugh. And so, you know, I think it's really wonderful to just be yourself and not feel like everything has to be somber and sad and depressing. It is sad, but there's also the humanity that comes to the bedside, and it's all the emotions that make us human, and joy and laughter and humor is just part of it.
You quote a man named Randall who you worked with, and he, I guess, he put a note on his door, and it read, "Yes, I have cancer. No, I'm not dead. Okay, now that we've had the cancer conversation, please leave your sadness at the door and come on in. Please tell me about your life. Tell me a joke or a story. Share a memory of our lives together. I love you, Randall." I mean, I have to say, I made a like note to self to put something like that on the door when I'm going to need it at the end of my life.
It's so important, because if you're the visitor and you step in and you want to know about the prognosis and the treatments and the pain, and you just want to talk about cancer, and then the next person comes into the room and that's what they want to know because they're worried and they're scared and they're sad that they're going to lose you. And a lot of times people are bringing their own grief to the room. And so the person who's dying is really having to tend to a lot of other people's emotions at a time when they really need a friend and someone to talk to and someone to share their story with, their memories, their hopes and dreams for that person's future. And so we put notes on the door a lot. Sometimes we put notes on the door saying, please only stay for 10 minutes because they're having a lot of visitors. And sometimes it's hard for a person to ask people to leave. So sometimes we even include that. But the idea is to think about what a person might want to talk about, or even ask, what would you like to talk about? But remember that a person is so much more than their disease up until their very last breath.
And it's so easy when you're dying to think of yourself that way, right? You're the thing that's essentially killing you.
Absolutely. And that's part of what our work is as doulas, is to remember that there's a full life going on around that disease.
What do you do as an end-of-life doula when you can sense lots of unfinished business, let's say in a family? Maybe anger, resentments, guilt. I mean, there's a long list of really difficult feelings. I mean, not everything is going to always get tied. And I'm not saying anything gets tied up easily when anyone's dying. But for some, I think it doesn't resolve anything when someone dies. In fact, it can make it worse.
Absolutely. And we have to be okay with that too. I mean, we can't always fix everything, and everything isn't intended to be fixed. Forgiveness isn't intended to be for every single person. Sometimes people can't forgive someone, and that's their right to not mm-hmm. forgive if they don't want to. But there are times where we do have family conversations. We've had big Zoom calls with families from all around the country, family members getting on to talk through things that are unsettled and unfinished. And so if there's an opportunity and our client wants to heal or attempt to in some way, we'll reach out. And if not, then we try to make peace with that just through the conversations that we have, or the client writing their own letter that never gets sent, or whatever might feel meaningful for them.
You write about your husband, who was married before you got married. He lost his wife. She had a brain aneurysm. She was pregnant with triplets. She died. The babies died. I cannot imagine the kind of grief Mark, your husband, must have felt and probably still feels to this day. But, you know, grief is obviously so much of life, but also so much of dying as well. What can you tell us from either Mark's experience or your own watching people as they struggle with life and death?
Yeah, well, Mark's story obviously was so, so tragic. And to add to that, her name was Ronnie, and she died on Mother's Day, which was the one day that she wanted to celebrate the most. And so, you know, she died about 30 years ago now. And Mark and I still have moments. We'll mark the moment on Mother's Day. We'll talk about it. I have three children now. We have three children. And they will call him and check in with him. And grief is still a part of Mark's life. It's okay. Just yesterday, we actually drove by the mountain where he had proposed to her. Uh-huh. And he told the story to me. Again, we hadn't driven by there in years and years. And so grief is something that it never goes away, because the amount you love equals the amount you grieve. And if we didn't have grief, we wouldn't have love. And so I think the reason that Mark and I have been able to work so well together in our marriage is because we've always made space for the grief, like maybe sometimes an unwelcome companion for Mark, but truly part of who he is this grief journey that he was on and is still on. And it takes different forms, and it might not be as difficult for Mark on a day-to-day basis as it was back then, but he still grieves, and he always will. And that's something I actually love about him.
And it's important to tell stories, right? I mean, to, in a sense, once someone dies, to keep those stories alive.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And I remember the first year that I was with Mark, I mean, he was crying every day, multiple times, and telling me stories over and over about Ronnie. And I think that was part of the beauty of us, was just making space for his grief when it was really, really big and new and raw. I think that brought us together, because I really could see his capacity to love, you know, wrapped in his grief. It was just so amazing.
But we often, I think grief makes other people uncomfortable. So we want them, the grieving person, to get over it so we don't feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's our own problem, really.
I mean,
if we could let people grieve, it would be a beautiful thing. But we, especially in our culture here, have a hard time. There are some cultures where grief is just released in a big, huge way, but we don't do that. We keep ourselves fairly zipped up, and we let the grief out when it's convenient. And sometimes we block other people from grieving because of our own fears of all the emotions. And I think if we could just unzip ourselves a little bit to be open to allowing grief to be part of our everyday lives, we'd all be a lot healthier.
I saw a headline about people throwing their own funerals before they died, I guess as a way to hear what everyone has to say about you, what a wonderful person you were. What do you think of that?
I think it's kind of fun. I've had it happen a few times with clients, and it's usually a certain person who's very, very prepared and solid and strong and ready to die. You know, they have a certain group of friends that maybe they want to gather one last time, and it becomes sort of a memorial with certain songs playing and, you know, certain food being mm-hmm. served and such. And I think it's a beautiful thing for the right person.
Yeah. Telling jokes and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was reading about, I'm not sure this is the exact name of the movement, but it was referred to as the Don't Die movement, which is either using products or exercise routines promising to extend life and sometimes even, you know, the possibility of immortality. As an end-of-life doula, what are your thoughts about that? I think it's largely very wealthy people that are doing this. Or people that are deeply into technology that think, well, if I can tweak this or that, then I can live to be 250 years old. Obviously defying mortality, but what do you think about that?
I've never heard of that, but my first immediate reaction is, you know, there is a natural progression to our lifespan for a reason, and we're living longer and longer as it is. I mean, we're living to the points where our bodies oftentimes have a hard time keeping up with that. So I also notice like there's a longevity craze going on right now too. And so people are taking all kinds of supplements and doing everything to extend their life. And I think if we can extend our health span, that's a beautiful thing. And if we can stay healthy, that's wonderful. But I think the idea of not dying ever is, you know, the don't die is, that's kind of a lot to put on yourself and to really aim for. I think being healthy and living in your heart and gathering friends and being in community and all the things that we do on the outside are equally as important as the things we do on the inside.
When we talk about living a life of meaning and purpose, you know, as someone who has sat as people have been dying, and I think of Viktor Frankl talking about, you know, meaning being the most sort of essential part of what it is to be a human being. How do you see meaning and purpose?
I think that harkens back to the question, did I make a difference? Is the world a better place because I was here? And I think, you know, next to love, that is the most important thing. And I think we make meaning through our personal relationships and the people we love. And we make meaning by how we live our life. Was I kind? The simple things again. It's not like, did I build a library or, you know, did I cure a disease? It's the simple things that we do every single day to treat our neighbors a certain way with kindness and generosity so that we can live in community together. That is meaning making. It's everyday meaning. It's not the big things again. It's not the fireworks. It's the simple things that we do every day that really, I believe, lead to a meaningful life.
You have a what you call a final checklist. One, who matters most? Two, what matters most? Three, what worries you when lying awake in bed at night? Four, what brings you joy when you're awake at daytime? Five, what is left unsaid? Six, what is left undone? That those are the kind of profound questions that we all have to figure out how to answer one way or the other?
Yeah, I developed that list after going in to meet people when I was new doing this work with maybe 100 questions as a security blanket and realized that I could tone it down to those 6 questions and pretty much find out what I needed to do to work with a certain client. But over time, I started asking myself these questions. And now lots of my friends and a lot of my clients and people I know ask those questions of themselves every month, because that's how we keep a clean slate. That's how we make those phone calls and say, we're sorry, and I love you, and I miss you, and you've been a really special person in my life, and thank you for whatever you need to say thank you for. By asking those questions and tuning into what we're worrying about at night is really important, because that's how we can heal. If there is a broken relationship that we're worrying about, we might need to heal it. So I've kind of condensed those questions into those 6 questions of purpose and meaning that I like to use with my clients, but I think they're really good everyday questions that we can all ask ourselves.
We're almost out of time here. We've talked about I love you, I thank you, and I'm sorry. How important is that to address at the end of life or during life itself?
It's really important. And, you know, it's it's so much better if you can do it along the way, because healing can take place earlier. And sometimes trying to find somebody who you might have done something to when you were in high school is impossible. Mm-hmm. So just say the words as you live your life, and you don't have to be scrambling and searching so hard at the end of life.
Diane Button, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. Thank you so much for the work that you do as well.
Thank you so much, too, for having me.
Absolutely. She's an end-of-life doula, author of What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, thanks so much for joining us.